Badgers, welcome to another episode of the podcast. I'm joined with my co-host today, James Bledge. Say hello, James.
Hello, everyone. Hello.
And my name is Sam Cooper. And we've got a very special guest, James.
Yes, Andy Ewens from Woking Golf Club, which is, how many W's are there, Sam?
Well, there's the three famous W's, aren't there? Can you name them?
Woking, Warpleston, West Hill.
Oh, very good. But it's a rich...
Was there, not more?
Golf,
did you never tag Wentworth onto that?
No, or, well, no, it's different down the road,
just,
isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
New Zealand's just down the road from you, isn't it?
Yeah, New Zealand's just down the road. You've got a few, all close to each other, really. So you've got St George's Hills.
It's just an amazing bit of topography, isn't it?
My favourite bit of golf and land is the Surrey Heathlands.
I think it's the most underrated, globally, maybe not in England, but globally, it's such an underrated park. You know, everyone travels to East Coast of Scotland, don't they? And maybe even our bit in the Northwest England to play Lynx Golf Badge. But going and playing the golf of the Surrey Heathlands is got to be one of the best. In terms of the density and the quality, it's extraordinary.
And it's different to what I'm kind of used to, obviously, working Lynx all day to see. Yeah. I think Heathlands are the best photography you can get is on Heathlands. And, well, my sister lived in Surbiton. And when me and Jen started dating, we went and she carried from here when we went and played Woking before your time there. Yeah. And that was the last time I'd been. So there's obviously been a hell of a lot of work done since then. So, yeah.
Was that before they dug the bunker on the 4th?
I can hardly even remember, you know. I did yesterday, never mind. I don't know, for 12, 15 years ago or whatever. But maybe, Andy, you could start off by telling us about your career, where you started off and how you ended up where you are.
Yeah, I've been in the industry 30 years, sort of left school. Dad was like, what are you going to do? Come on. And I didn't know really, so he said, well, come on, I'm going to sign you up to the army, because that's, you know, I was a sporty sort of person. He said, no, I just thought he was laughing, joking around, until we got in the car and we went down to Guildford in a way, and there was an army recruiting round the back, I remember it, and we started walking towards the door, and I'm thinking, oh my God, he's actually serious. I believe a lot in fate, but on the day we just went to open the door, and there was a bit of paper on the door saying, away at a battalion parade, be back open Wednesday. And this was Saturday, and I was like, whew. So I sort of got home, I thought, open
like
the paper.
Had like a 3-and-a-bit day reprieve.
Yeah.
That is a sliding doors moment, isn't it? I mean, if they had been there, you'd probably be sitting there.
I bet that focuses the mind, though, on the old job search.
Oh, it does. And you sort of... everything came to light, and I thought, my God, because come Wednesday we were going to go back there. So if they hadn't been away, I'd have been in the army. I know that. That's,
I'm 100% going to threaten my kids with that from now on, even at this age. Like, right, you're going to take you down to the army,
do the CCF down at First West Kirby.
But yeah, luckily for me, I opened the paper, local paper, as soon as I got home, and it's flying through it. And there was I lived just near opposite Perford Golf Club at the time.
Okay.
And they were looking for a trainee. And I thought, cool. So I sort of applied for that straight away. And they got a phone call back, asked me to go in there that week. So I said to my dad, look, no need to go. I've got a job.
Don't worry, Dad, I'll take it from here.
Yeah. So I was quite lucky, went there and I got the job as an apprentice greenkeeper. And started there and absolutely loved it. You know, so I worked my way up there to deputy over sort of seven years, and then at the time it was American Golf, and it was good, but been there a while and saw they built a golf course next door called Traditions. They built it on a sort of a floodplain, so I sort of saw the grow in there a bit, but it was one of those golf courses.
Not always the best idea in the world.
No, when you sort of see it being built and you think, whew, got to get out of here. But, before anything goes wrong. But and then like, I was quite lucky, I sort of where we are in, say, the Surrey area, there was a job going at the time at Queenwood Golf Club. So I had a friend who was working there at the time, so I went along and got the job there. And then I was quite lucky for me, after probably 6 months, there's a first assistant job available, sort of in-house, and I was lucky to get the job.
Is that the start of the build kind of thing? How old was Queenwood at that point?
So it'd been a few years old, so I started under Ian McMillan.
All right, okay.
So with him, then obviously after that he moved on, and then Cameron, so I was with Cameron there for us, so about 6 years.
Was that a bit of a culture shock going from one, not to, but you know, you always hear how Queenwood sort of is the pinnacle of presentation. Yeah. So did it sort of feel like back then that you were sort of working on something that was polished to perfection?
Yeah, it's quite sort of scary. I was a deputy at the time, and I was going to move down just as a greenkeeper. But you suddenly think to yourself, God, everything's going to be amazing. You've got to up your standards, which was great. And I think when I went along, there was, you sort of had to be clean shaven, your boots polished in a way.
Yeah, that's true, isn't it? Clean shaven and boots.
And it was
polished.
It was brilliant because that was sort of me. I loved that sort of thing in the work. But we had a great team. There was a big team. I think we had 24, and then we had four attempts. There's only 28 of us in the way for 18 holes. And it was just everything had to be perfection. Yeah, and it was great. And you could see the golf course maturing. And then that's sort of when I fell in love with heather in a way. I was off site most of the winter times collecting heather, bringing it back. And then, because heather's instant view, it's just pretty amazing when you go to Queenwood.
Yeah.
All the heather was brought in. Yeah, a lot of it was there. So
that's how you did this at G West, isn't it?
Yeah, which we translocated it from up in the Ochil Hills.
Bit of a commonality with McLay Kidd and sort of taking that approach.
Yeah, we could touch on that. After Andy tells about his, and be quite interested to tell some
because it was a bit in common.
There was a lot in common with the stuff we did to you, what you did.
So after Queenwood, where did you?
It's hard when you're at Queenwood, you get looked after well, but there's so many of you there, and to move up the ranks there's pretty tough. No one leaves, so I had to sort of go back to become a deputy at Burr Hill. Under Rob Sergi, he was good. Rob's a good lad. He was in charge of sort of all the golf courses. He sort of let me carry on there a bit, and he was good. He was really good
to
me.
Top bloke, Rob.
Yeah, so I was there for about 3 years, 3.5 years, and it was good. And then there's a job advertised at Buckinghamshire Golf Club. We're looking for a course manager, and I just thought, well, you just go for it in a way. And I got an interview, lucky enough, and I just thought, well, I was a hungry sort of greenkeepers you are, and I just went round. I did a documentation on how we could improve the course and the surroundings, and I was quite lucky. I managed to get the job there. It was great. We're home with the Ladies European Tour, and the sort of first year they said, right, we want to start holding some tournaments here. And that's when I looked round and I sort of said, well, the course isn't really good enough. It's a John Jacobs design who I met. He was a great man, and we just thought we need to improve this. The bunkering was huge. Stones, I think most of them, 120 bunkers, and 64 were GUR every time it rained and washed down. So we looked into it.
Before the days of bunker lane, I'm guessing.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, it's a bit of farmland, but it was great. Nice greens. Yeah, it was really good. Everything was good there. But I went and saw John Jacobs, and I sort of said. And he knew. He goes, I know what you're going to say. You want to change the course, the bunkers. He goes, they're so out of date now. And it was amazing to hear that. And you think, wow. And we asked his permission. And
that's interesting. I always think it's almost a sign of the times when you end up with 120-odd bunkers. Because no golf course needs 120-odd bunkers. Like it just doesn't. If you can't have... Okay, if you're on the absolute flattest of land, then you will always need more. If you've got a bit of topography, you've got a bit of movement, that can be used to get rid of a bunch or just use that more intelligently. But half that number, and you can do a job. You always think one well placed bunker is worth half a dozen just fired in at random.
It's so, like it's draining time and money.
Well, what's that stat that it's a great stat, and I think about it quite often. Very roughly, and of course it varies, but something like the bunkers take up the same amount of resources greens to manage for you guys in terms of time and effort, especially if they're revetted. But whilst the average golfer might hit 36 putts in a round of golf, I think the average is between 3 and 4 bunker shots that you hit per round.
You can add 10 on it for me.
Yeah. Well, that's only because you can't get out of them. So, but it's 10 times more costly than your greens, basically per shot that's hitting them. And you think of that, and every golfer will come off the golf course and have judged a lot of it by the quality of the greens. I guess that's what you guys sort of that's the yardstick that you need to sort of help hang your hat on. But you know, bunkers are often something that stop you being able to focus your resources where they're most needed.
And technology's changed so much since the big 80s, 90s of the new golf courses being built. A lot of the bunkers. And you have to keep evolving with golf, and a lot of them haven't, you know, and they just stood still, and that's where...
And when technology did allow fairway bunkers to become redundant because the long boys just hit straight over the top of them, if you were to then build new bunkers at, you know, quote-unquote, the right distance, how often did they then take away the redundant bunkers that, you know, rarely, in our experience, you just end up building more bunkers. Mm-hmm. And now you have bunkers that the shorter hitters are finding that are no test for...
Let's keep moving because
I'm getting carried away. So you ended up sort of changing and rationalising some of that.
I brought sort of Tim Lobbin, who was sort of new, and we just sort of looked, and I put a feasibility project forward. We need a new irrigation system. The lake edges were all rotten and falling in, so I sort of got a plan together. We were owned by Asahi Beer Firm at the time. Really nice people to work, but they used to send a new sort of MD over every 3 years to run the club, and never had anything, didn't know anything about golf. A lot of them didn't play golf. They didn't speak a lot of English, so some of the meetings you'd have were tough. If you knew the Japanese, they would sit there and they'd go, and that would be it. And an hour later, you'd walk out of there, you know, I've just spent...
I might have lost
all
my job.
This time doing this. But then a day and a half later, he'll then answer your question. So you always have to give him time. So it was, but then I went in and I sort of said, look, I need about just under £3 million to change the golf course. And he sort of, they looked at me. I did the feasibility. We had a great finance director there. And we looked at how we could pay the money back, because you're always borrowing money off Asahi all the time, it felt like. So we sort of did a plan of buggies and new pathways, everything. So redo all the bunkering from 124 bunkers down to 62, reduce, all lined, everything. So more strategic. And it was great. He said, right. He said, well, I'm not going to go back to Japan and ask the bosses, you're going.
No.
So,
no way.
He said, I want you to go. So... it was great. I had to do a big presentation put together. I had to show it to him. Then they sent it. And then they sent me over to Tokyo to meet with the directors of Asahi, which was great. And
That's fascinating, isn't it?
What was that trip like?
Oh, it was brilliant, because I had an itinerary for 5 days, but it was up at 5:30. I had someone pick me up every day. This woman, she drove, took me everywhere on the train. So we went to north, south, because on the bullet train you're there in a couple of hours. So we went round some golf courses, and but before I went, I had to read through what you can and can't do. So when you're in a business meeting and when you get a business card, you can't just give it to them. You have to give them with both hands, take it, put it to the side.
All the customs.
Huge, and you can really come across rude if you don't do when you're eating, and you can't chit chat unless the main person starts the talk. So you go into these meetings, and we're going out for dinner with them, and you're thinking, just sit there, don't do this,
don't do anything wrong.
But it's great. But
what age were you then when you did that?
Let's see, I must have been, is it now? So it's late 30s.
Right, okay.
So it was great. You know, you sort of went there, found the custom, they went out quite a bit for the first 3 or 4 days, maybe massive drinking culture.
Really? Is that right?
In Japan, they said
on the sake.
But I mean, you work hard, you always go for a drink after work, they're always at work, they're never ill. But he said to me, how many times do you go out with your lads, you know, out? I said, well, maybe 2-3 times a week. I went, a year for a week. He goes, every day we go for a drink after. And If you work for Asahi, you're not allowed to walk into a pub that doesn't sell Asahi.
I was going to say, it probably helps if you own a beer company, doesn't it?
Go and have a gold card.
Yeah, so it was good to learn, and we saw everything. You know, you saw some sites, you saw a big sumo wrestler on a bike riding to this. And you're thinking, but it's amazing.
Is it a big bike or a little bike? It's a little bike in my
A little bike, head, and I wondered how...
It's in my head as well, are you?
But it's an amazing experience, you know, and it was... They looked after me so well. I mean, that's a great company. So,
would you have liked to have worked in Japan? Hirono or something?
It's very different. I mean, it's good where they have two greens on a lot of the golf courses.
Right.
So winter and summer, Benson, how they were doing with rise and the different grasses. And
do they call the bunkers Allisons over there? Am I right in thinking that?
Because I don't know.
Allison, one of Colt's design partners, and he went and built these really intricate, sort of frilly, lacy-edged bunkers. And I think they became known as Allisons. I'm going to get berated by Simon Haynes or similar.
Someone
now.
Someone up on that.
So did the presentation at the end of the week. They just sat there, asked a lot of questions. They obviously had, their English is a bit different, so had interpreters just all the time. And they were like, okay. And then at the end...
You must have been quite nervous or anxious, were you?
Yeah, I do enjoy standing up, but it's hard when you think they're the top people of Asahi.
Yeah.
And there's no expression. But it was all talk. I was doing all the talking to start with, and then they were asking questions through the interpreters. And I thought, but they'd all seen my presentation before in Japanese. They were reading it as we went. But then at the end of it, near the end of the presentation, they all just suddenly started speaking English to me.
Right. Really?
Yeah, and I thought, we've wasted a bit of time here. But it was good. They were quite stern. So about the money side, they were like, so you just want us to give you, we've been giving money. And you think, well, no, I want to pay the money back over a certain period of time. And then they really listened and they thought, wow, they've actually thought about this and how they're going to do it. Mm-hmm. And it went really well, I feel.
Did you have to pitch that? Did you have to pitch it purely on the economic side of things, the financial side of things, or is it partly the, you know, what you're trying to achieve, the emotional side of things, and you know, the fact that they are associated with something that could be a lot better?
Yeah.
Was it a bit of both?
A bit of both, but we did a feasibility survey, you know, how many hours it took to rate the bunkers, greens, we had all graphs to show.
It's a great exercise, I think, for everyone to do. Especially if you're building, you know, if you're building revetted bunkers and then you factor in the turf that you buy and this and the man out, so
Raking,
often
yeah.
it's overlooked, and you just think it doesn't cost us anything because it's just our time. But then you actually work out, well, how much do you get paid an hour, how many guys are on it, how many hours does it take, and then how often are you doing it?
It's usually,
and you
the
actually
language
quantify
the board
it.
Members understand.
Well, exactly, you quantify it, and as soon as you do that and you work out every bunker costs X number of pounds per year. And then I can absolutely understand that being a powerful tool to getting them to see the value in what you're trying to achieve.
And another thing is embarrassment because anyone Japanese flies in, because we're right next to Heathrow, flies into Heathrow, they'll play the Buckingham shit because it's owned by the Japanese. So weekends it was packed with, it was all Japanese. So if I showed them picture of the bunkers and said, you know, when it rains, 64, they thought it was embarrassing for them because their people they'd send over are seeing it like this. And I said, this is what we need to do, make it look amazing. So for them, it was more, well, the people we send over there and the other Japanese people, they'll come back and say how great it is and the experience, you know,
and the pride, because I feel that's a big part of the culture.
Exactly. So they were embarrassed when I showed photos of the golf course, of how it, you know, is redundant, some of the bunkers and the way things were. So they sort of, they really took it on board, but I sort of flew back, didn't get an answer, and come back, spoke to our Japanese MD at the club, and he said, oh, well done. And that was it. And then that was in, I think it was March time, I think I went, and then nothing. And then the end of August came.
Oh, as long as that?
Yeah, and then the Japanese MD came out in a buggy. I was on the 18th cutting the tees. And he came up to me, he goes, well done, you've got the money. And
oh,
I just thought, wow. And he goes, we won't start October. I said, well, it's impossible, you can't. You start in October, we won't start. And but I managed to sort of get it started in October. We did it over 2 years, 9 holes and 9 holes. And Yeah, and it was great. So we...
That must have been a huge operation for you to manage doing that then.
It was. You know, I'd project manage it myself. I went through a CDM, did all the health and safety. So I did everything there. You know, it was an amazing project, and I'm glad I did it for everything, because you were working with five different contractors a lot of the time, doing the pass, lake edges, irrigation, bunkering, shaping, turf.
What contractors did you use for all your shaping and stuff?
So we had Profusion with us for the 2 years. Lakes and Greens did the irrigation. Mm-hmm. And then, off the top of my head, I've got
Profusion are very, very popular amongst a lot of the Heathland guys. Use them, you know.
Yeah.
Very good shapers.
No. So it was brilliant. So I had all that going on. We had things go wrong. I mean, the stress sometimes. You know, the concrete pathway we're putting down to get, you know, the buggy side of things, you know, when they don't set in the winter time, and we had to rip a few up. It wasn't our fault. The contractors, I said no concrete to be delivered after 12 o'clock, but they always try it. But then the worst thing, we had a bridge at the back of my yard that connected our side of the land to the driving range at the back. It's also a public footpath to connecting. And that's a 20-ton limit. They just took a 5-ton mole plow over, bridge collapsed.
Oh, no.
As you got to the other end. It was lucky no one said, but got over, but the whole thing, and then suddenly you're like, it's a, you know, an 80 to 100 metre bridge. It's not just a small bridge, and it's the main access. So straight away, the council, we're going to fine you because it's shut. You can't keep it shut. And then, so at the end of the
you
project...
You must have stressed out your head with that part of it.
That was the last thing we were doing. That's all we had to do. So the project was finished just there.
Imagine it happened at the start.
Oh. But do you know what I really enjoyed? I mean, if you ever see a bridge coming in, pre-built, this was huge. We had to do a lot of work. Company, I think Beaver Bridges, absolutely amazing what they did. Bought it, had cranes. It was fun to see a new one go in and the work.
How long
to do.
Did you say 80 metres?
Yeah, it's 80 to 100 metres long, the bridge. It wasn't a small...
That's a huge thing. How much, not a specific, but I've literally got no idea how much a bridge costs. Tell me it costs £1 million or 100 grand. I've got no idea.
Not too bad, but it's £128,000.
Yeah, well...
But it's the infrastructure of getting the bridge brought in. Yeah. You can't... It's all pre-built, so you've got to have a proper trailer that turns. We had to board where we came into our yard and get it in the cranes. We had to do all the stuff. A lot to do, but it was really satisfying doing it. I know it sounds funny.
No, this is brilliant.
But it was amazing. Another project. But, yeah, I thought to myself, you know, could have really been in trouble. Lucky Lakes and Greens, Mark, he was fine, you know. But it's just I was on the green, cutting the green, and he just walked up to me really pale. He goes, your bridge has collapsed. I said, what? He goes, the bridge has collapsed. It's gone.
Jeez.
And I was just...
What exact kind of road was going across this bridge? What kind of traffic was going across it?
It was just buggies. It was a 20-ton limit bridge. We found that when the insurance came, that the people who built this bridge were actually in court for another three bridges that had collapsed over time. So it wasn't, they weren't built right. And then we had someone assess it and look in it. It had faults.
It's like the Italian mafia building all those bridges with dodgy concrete.
So you can imagine it. That was the ending. It was once I finished everything, I thought, wow, I'm not going to have another project like that.
And I'm fascinated about this bridge. Did not having this bridge, did that cause massive disruption for you getting other ways in the course, or could you bypass
it?
No, it
was just our driving range, luckily, everything else. But it was a main public footpath.
And that's why the council wanted to fine you, kind of thing.
Yeah, they were. It was big, but. Luckily I spoke with them and the health and safety I'd done was fine, and they said let's keep it between us where no one was hurt. Because the bridge, whose was it? Was it ours or was it the council's?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but it's their rights of way.
When I sort of said we think it's your bridge, we said look, we'll take care of the bridge, and they said brilliant, we'll back you all the way, don't need to go. And they were so good to me. They didn't fine me, because they were going to fine me £15,000 for just shutting the bridge.
But just for the right of way not existing.
Yeah, just for the right of way. You physically can't. I couldn't do anything about that. Yeah. But
there's not many course managers that can see that installed the bridge.
You could
a tight rope.
But as soon as you take the sort of blame and say, "Look, we'll take the cost of the bridge," best people in the world. Oh, they love you, and they're like, what you're doing is brilliant. We'll back well you done. All the way. So no,
how long from start to finish from getting this bridge put in?
I think the bridge, it must have, I think we were 4 months, something like that. It wasn't, because you have to get it built properly, and what you have to decide what kind of bridge you want. So we've made steel with a wood frame over the top, so it's always going
to
last.
We need to get a picture
time.
Of this bridge and
yeah,
the
we also need to move on past the bridge, because we could, yeah. In 20 minutes' time, we could still be talking about this bridge.
It's quite
yeah,
funny,
please so, send yeah, but... them. Okay, so how long after that project sort of ended did you stay there for?
I was probably there another year. And I was quite lucky that I got informed about Woking, and they sort of they said, oh, there's a job at Woking, we'd like you to sort of go for it. We'd like to discuss it with you anyway to start with. We'll, because Richard, who I knew, was a general manager there.
Richard Pennell.
I went to college with him.
Richard Pennell, who we've talked about many times on the
podcast.
He's brilliant.
He's so intelligent. I mean,
bloke.
Unbelievable.
Top bloke.
But he sort of, I went to college with him 20-something years ago. But he just sort of rang me, says, I'd like to come meet you. And he said, look, I know you're at the Buckinghamshire. And he goes, I can meet you halfway. He's sending me an email going, I can meet you halfway. I said, well, I only live 2 minutes around the corner from Woking Golf Club. I travel to Buckinghamshire every day. And then he just rung me. He goes, where do you live? I said, well, just round the corner. I can meet you in the coffee shop. Yeah, it's quite sort of, it was quite funny. And he just explained about the job role and then, you know, the interview process and sort of did that. And yeah, I was really lucky to get the job. And
well, let's give a bit of background on Woking then, because I think, you know, a lot of listeners out there will know about it and have heard about it. But, you know, I think that Woking is one of the special places of golf, to my mind. I know you think the same, Bledge. But
yeah, I loved it when I played it, and been following Andy's progress on it for years and seen the great work done. It's just a stunning looking golf course.
It's amazing, but significant. You know, the architectural pedigree, there are certain places that really sort of drove the game forward, and that is absolutely one of the, you know, one of a handful that you would put at the top of the list. The greats, John Lowe and the book on, you know, Concerning Golf, I think that they wrote, a lot of the architectural practices that 100 and something years later we still apply to all manner of courses in different ways. You know, you don't apply everything the same way, but the sort of thinking principle of challenging the good golfer, that really, so they say, came from when there was a bunker dug in the middle of the fourth fairway down at Woking, and the likes of Tom Simpson is, you know, going out and looking at it and being blown away by the ramifications, because until that time, and these sorts of things go in and out of fashion, but before that time, it was always a bunker was there to catch the bad shot of the bad golfer. Mm-hmm. And you know, the premise is, well, the bad golfer is going to have a bad day no matter what's in the way, but the good golfer should have a challenge. And the complete reversal of that way of thinking is, you know, there's a lot that came from Woking. So, you know, were you always acutely aware of that historical significance and the real strategic interest of that course in particular?
I knew quite a bit about it, but not hugely. And it was, that's why it's really interesting reading some of the books about how the golf courses in the Heathland started, you know, with the train, lines, and it's amazing when you read some of the books and the history books, and that really gets me into architecture. You know, you suddenly get drilled in with everything, and when you read them and you realize how everything was built and where it is and all the golf clubs, and it's fascinating, and the plot of land it was, you know, built on, and those, and why they were built on these areas, it's really detailed. So I didn't know the full package about Woking, so I knew about the fourth hole, and yeah, I've played it before with the greens are pretty amazing, the size and the undulations. And then
massive greens. Some of the, you know, you had pretty good greens when you were back down at Deal, Bledge, didn't you?
But we were 1.7 hectares at Deal.
Cool. Yeah. Through about 1.5, but we extended a bit more. Yeah. We'd like to do some more. But it's, I mean, the undulations.
But I think Woking's must be one of the best inland collection of greens in England.
They're always incredibly fast greens when I played it as well.
Yeah, so we try and keep that sort of. The hardest part is the pin positions there. like with every golf
big
course.
Big undulation though, aren't they? Like, yeah. That's probably part of the reason as well why they're
and it's
so
tough
fast.
It's how fast you can get them. We've 12 and a half is probably fine. We had them at 13 once.
12 and a half is
and you sort of that's where it's not enjoyable. You know, you have to take that in consideration. But no, they're amazing greens. And I think once you play it, you have to play it again.
Oh, it's
because
of
the pin where you think,
every
now
time
I know
you play it.
The pin's there, I have to go in this direction.
It's,
like a lot of golf
it's a thinking golf course, and you've really got to pick away the layers and spend some time to really understand it. But what was the course there? What was it like when you arrived then? What you walked around for the first time, what triggered in your mind and you said, right, the biggest difference I can make is...
I think it's a hard one. When you've been at other golf clubs and sort of the Queenwoods and all these, it's big things, presentation, you know, straight away I'm quite huge on hand mowing. You know, it's all about sometimes the stature, you know, if you hand mow your greens. But I looked at the size and the way we could work with the team, and straight away we sort of started hand mowing greens, tees. The tees, they're square tees, but they were round, just where, you know, people use a triple and it just becomes round. So it was just what you have to do to start when you go in somewhere. Visually wise, you have to make a difference. So everyone goes, oh, yeah, he's looks quite good. If
we're moving forward.
Yeah,
he's arrived.
Yeah. That's it. And you, those little things there straight away. But we were really, like a lot of Heathland Golf Club's trees, you know, were just overhanging. The heather was in decline, not through sort of not people working on it, but it was just where the grasses were taking over. They were always in the shade. Moss was coming through and out competing. So we had to... There was a big plan there. The first thing was the surfaces, making sure all the surfaces were good. We didn't have a good irrigation system. It wasn't great at all. So
that's how we met initially, because you came to the deal to look at our irrigation system with Richard.
Yeah.
And the when was that installed then?
That was 2019, end of 2019, 20. It was just...
Perfect timing.
Yeah, so we finished. I think we had Adrian Abbott building the... irrigation shed. That's all we had to do with the pumps and everything. Mm-hmm. But because of COVID, you couldn't have two people in there. So we had to, we had an irrigation system built, but we couldn't use it because the pump set wasn't there in a way. And the COVID hit, and we were lucky. Adrian Abbott's amazing, you know, what he does. Yeah. And he just spent time in a couple of them, kept the roof off, you know, but built. So we just got it in time. We're quite lucky our membership paid for it, you know, loan notes. Mm-hmm. They got together the money within a couple of months. It was amazing.
That's fantastic.
But if we hadn't, they really pushed forward, so we've got to get it done now. If we waited another year, obviously COVID would have kicked in, then we wouldn't have had it done till probably 21, 22.
And was that design, who designed the system?
Roger Davey.
So did Roger design that around your mindset of watering from heather in?
Yeah.
Whereas before, possibly was it with the pipes in different places so the water was going everywhere, and then obviously heather's not
exactly just the sprinklers in the middle, just full 60. So we had to look at the planning ahead as well of the irrigation system of where we're looking at putting heather, because I looked and when I looked how much heather we needed to bring in, it was about 18,500 square meters to make a difference to what we wanted to do. Then we had to think ahead and think, right, do we put irrigation here or there? Where do we put couplers, you know, QCVs on greens and areas? And it was great because Roger designed it, and then you sort of had, he did it from the sort of outside in, and then you could, we had a sort of chance to say, well, let's not put one there because we're doing this and move it around. So he's all good.
It's a good point that I think just for people who slightly glazed over there, but that you who don't quite, I guess, is that because heather wants a really dry climate, and then if you are, you know, you think of the proper heaths and generally in the south of England and generally places where it's sort of a bit dusty and dry, and you think of the heather stood there. So if you are spraying from the irrigation heads into the heather, you're going to end up with grasses coming through that outcompete the heather. Yeah. So if you put them on the edge and fire them back down the center of the fairway, you can keep it completely dry and sort of have like a very clear boundary between the grass and the and where the heather starts. Is that the concept?
Yeah, it's a part circle on the edges and full circle in the middle a lot of the time.
So you have three sorts of
triple row. Yeah, triple row.
I think at the
Triple Rose, the absolute.
I think at the Addington,
Rolls Royce of a system.
I think at the Addington where Ryan's done, we've got a big double fairway. I think he's got
eight rows.
Is it 8 rows across that?
It's an amazing place.
Yeah,
but we digress again. So obviously irrigation then was a big project for you.
Yeah, and I put a system in at the Buckinghamshire, so they sort of allowed me to have a look. Roger's Davey's brilliant, you know, and he designed it and said, look, have a look. And then we sort of came up with a plan where we wanted to move a few sprinklers here and there. We wanted to make sure we had the best we can have, so a new transfer pump, new tanks, new, everything. If we're going to do it, let's do it the best we can. We're not going to have to
come back
to it.
Where did you get your water from there? You've got the pond on the right of the 18th.
Yeah, we've got a big reservoir. We've got a 30,000 cube reservoir to the right of our fifth, which is near the train line. Back of the fourth, going to the fifth there. And there's a stream that runs through underneath the railway from the river, so we can take off the stream for the winter. And we've also got a borehole as well, so we
perfect. That's a
perfect volume, you know.
Yeah.
What's your abstraction a year? What are you allowed to take?
So we can abstract about 38,000 cube, even though we have 30,000, but we can top up, which we found's okay. But our line is up for renewal in. Where it's 21, 22 years, and you sort of think 25 years. So when we do that, we'll extend it to 40,000 cube. We've got a bit of land we can, just because we have the water and we're allowed to. So
Bled's just gone green with envy here.
I know.
What are you,
500 cube, 500 cube tank. Allowed to take 28.
Yeah.
Yeah, of which last year we were ready to wax it by the start of July. To be honest, we could have. And
fortunately,
then
a million and eight cubes then fell for the next.
I know, and then we ended up only using 24 or something like that. So
yeah, but a lot. You find a lot of clubs now that have sold a lot of land, and they haven't got reservoirs. Mm. So when you go to a lot of, we went to a meeting with the Environment Agency, and they were sort of saying, if you're off mains, it's going to be trouble in years to come. And they were advising everyone with reservoirs, but a lot of people there said, we haven't got the room.
We were talking about this with Adrian.
Yeah, it's one of my sort of little passion projects. I always sort of think about it because I completely agree. You know, if you've, it's the holistic approach, isn't it? You know, you've got to think that at some point, might be 10 years, might be 50 years, who knows? But at some point, there's a hose pipe ban every so often, and that's only going to get worse. And if you've got too much water on at certain times a year and you can drain it into a reservoir, well, that would help. And then if you can then use some of that water, and yes, okay, you're going to always have to top it up with evaporation rates. But there are ways, you know, there are ways that you can help mitigate that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's just this holistic approach of becoming a little bit more sustainable when it's becoming increasingly competitive with things going away from the industry, you know, fewer products that you guys are going to have. Mm-hmm. You've got to get the basics in order now before legislation or opportunities or, as you say, land is sold without due consideration. All these things are happening.
Mm-hmm.
And at some point, there are probably going to be a load of golf courses that have, it's too late and they've tripped up and they're a bit screwed, really. Mm-hmm. So,
but when you're with the older courses, you sell, you know, you've got everything's firm and fast. Everyone wants firm and fast.
Yeah.
And then you have an irrigation system is the worst thing for an old club because everyone wants the firm and fast, but they watch Sky and you see the tournaments, you see they're amazing.
Diamond cut green fields.
Oh, yeah, lovely lush green. But they don't take into account what's involved. But when you have, when we had irrigation, I knew we got a bit juicy, some of the fairways, not too much, but they're like, oh, we're over watering. But before, we were firm and fast, but didn't have much grass.
Mm,
it's what do you want? And it's surprising where 60 and over want the firm and fast, you know, as it used to be, and then the sort of younger people sometimes want the nice lush fairways,
They're wrong.
Yeah, it's a hard one to. As soon as you get an irrigation system, I think for the old clubs and yourselves, you have to be so careful. Even though you've got individual head sprinklers, you've got everything.
I think it's such a good point because to me, and look, I'm not a turf guy, so you know, tell me how wrong I am, guys, but. To me, it feels like an irrigation system is more like insurance. It's like you've got to have it, but really, you don't want to use it. You know, you're using it to...
Well, we teach responsible irrigating.
To avoid disaster, you know, because I guess if you've spent X amount of pounds on an irrigation system, especially if the members have put their hands in their pockets to actually fund that, they want to see it being used. They don't want to feel like they've paid for something that is pointless. Why have we just shelled out all this cash for something that we don't want to use?
And don't see.
But then, like you say, I can only imagine if you do reach for it and you have it on a little more than perhaps you might otherwise, in to your eyes at least, then it's not long before the grass starts to change, the course starts to change, how it's played. And if ever there was a course that needs to be firm and fast, it's Woking.
Yeah.
And there was, I very brief digression, last time I was at Woking, I played it in probably the firmest conditions imaginable. And it was the day after a cookie jar party 2 years ago, and it was frozen. And it was like literally completely frozen. But you guys stay on greens, don't you? You don't go to frost greens or anything like that. And the ball bounced, every time the ball lands on the fairway, it bounced 50 yards in the air. Because it was rock hard.
You'd be in heaven with that. You'd love that.
It would, but it's amazing because you have to, you know, you can't just be in position Z and whack it high in the air because it doesn't work. You've got to land it short of the greens and you've got to see it roll up. Mm. And that's, to me, as an architecture nerd, that's what Woking is. That's getting in the right position off the tee, being able to get to run it into the greens. It works. So how have you been able to, have you tried to sort of educate the younger guys who might think that, you know, Augusta conditions are what they should have at Woking, or is it, does it just sort of, as it's a few years from the irrigation going in, it sort of fades from people's minds and it's less of a hot topic?
Yeah, I think the first year we did a lot of overseeding because now we had the irrigation, we could look after it, but we started feeding the fairways, and sometimes you think, oh, no, you shouldn't feed, but you need to if you want to have a great, you know, a great sward. We had to look at feeding, but it comes with, you know, sometimes you had to be careful of the leaching because we found the heather around the outside of the fairways over 5 years now has just started receding back, so then you have to strip out, so we've got a 5-year program stripping out areas. But a lot, the members love it, you know, they like the firm and fast, and it's hard to keep that. But for the first year, a lot of them were saying, you know, oh, we're a lot greener than we used to be. And you know, but I said it's a tough thing. They're still trying to get the grass to grow because you want that thickness. Mm-hmm. I said you've got to wait a year.
Yeah, everything get the balance. There's a difference between general maintenance and changing what you previously were unable to do because you didn't have the resource to get that coverage.
And it is, and it's perception. Everyone thinks, but again, they see on TV or what people are doing down the road or anything. They play, most of our members are members at other golf courses. And it's surprising, they come back going, oh, this and this and that. But this year or last year, it was the first time we started off the year crisscrossing the fairways. Mm-hmm. And I put a few pictures on Twitter and we did. And some of the members wanted, it's surprising, some of our members said they prefer the crisscross because one of our golfers, he's off scratch, he can get his drives are 43 yards longer. And I sat there and I went, what? He said, oh, with crisscross, I can get a longer drive than light and dark. So when we had to do light and dark, obviously we have to do it from every hole different. So up the right, down the left, where you get the run. But when you start getting some of the members saying that, you're thinking, wow, yeah, you're taking it to another level.
I've not heard before. That's a degree of self-awareness on your drives that's beyond mine. You know,
I'd heard that once Donald Trump was getting outdriven by his playing partner, and he says, "Why is this? You never outdrive me." He says, "Well, because you're hitting it up the left, and I'm hitting up the right, and the fairways have been cut anti-clockwise, so I'm hitting up the light shade and the way the grass is lying." So he got the green staff to reverse out all night, reversing the cut, and then didn't play
and then
the next
didn't
day.
Up the next didn't time. I heard that. That's that.
It's a beller. Yeah.
So irrigation then, you've started to sort, or you started then to change the composition of the grasses and everything else and heather. What about the trees and the wider vegetation management? Because that's something that I was so impressed with when I went most recently. So
we were quite thick. Everything was quite thick and overrun with trees on the whole golf course. And it made a big difference. You couldn't see from hole to hole to hole through. And we had a picture, I think I put a picture on Twitter about a year ago, of we took a picture of our 13th it was a picture in the clubhouse 100 years ago where it showed a pitch quite up high, looking from 13 along 14 to the clubhouse. And you could see the clubhouse, there wasn't trees there at all. And
yeah,
we got the drone up and we took the same picture from the same angle. And it was amazing. You couldn't really see the clubhouse and it was overrun. And that made a big difference when the membership saw that, because I put it into a members report when we were talking about it, and they were like, wow. So we sort of looked at this, and the first year I was there, there was a great captain. I sort of said, look, I want to take these trees out behind two. I didn't have any, I just thought it's going to look great.
Mm-hmm.
This can we two up to 11 and five, that triangle?
Yeah.
I said, just, and he said, are you sure? I said, yeah, honestly, I can see how it's going to look. It's going to be great. And he said, okay. And then we just went and did it.
How good's that? Just to trust you, just to back you, because that's always what you need at some degree. You need.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter how well you sell it, you still need a degree of trust and to take that first step.
And he was great. But if it had gone wrong, then wow, I'd have been in so much trouble. It's great because in the vista now, from standing on the top of Lenny, you can see round, and that just led to everyone going, opening their eyes, thinking, wow.
Where else can we do this?
Yes, but then. The next year's captain, who's good again, they've all been really supportive, said, look, and I thought, as well, you can't just keep cutting trees down because certain members don't like it. So we had to look at putting a sort of document together of why we're doing this, because I kept saying our heather was in decline because it was shaded, a lot of moss. And I said, you know, I think we're the oldest Heathland golf club in Surrey, because I think Sunnendale's in the Berkshire.
Yeah, so, that's honest,
but I said, you know, we were sort of iconic car, we've got all this, but we're losing our heather. You know, we have to, if we don't do something now, then in 10 years' time, we might not have much at
all. Absolutely.
And then suddenly that changes the architecture and the playability of it. Everyone's can just boom it everywhere and not think about it. So we sort of, one of my lads, Joe Hobden, who was brilliant, he was a young lad, but he was into ecology and he worked with ecologists, and then he wanted to become a greenkeeper. So he became a greenkeeper with us for a bit. And he said, well, I can do a document. And then we sort of sat down together and we thought, well, we'll call this document Regenerating the Heath, and explain to the membership and other people outside the membership, if they want to know, the residents, why we're looking at taking some trees down, bringing the heather back, all the work we do with transplanting and seeding and everything. And it was a lovely bit all about the wildlife, and it just covered everything we were trying to achieve and how the club would look and if it didn't. And it went down really well. I gave a talk to the membership as well, and it was the members that turned up, you knew were going to be the die-hard older ones that were just sitting there waiting to chuck things at you. But it went really well, and they had a few questions, but nothing. And then it sort of led to us bringing a forestry company in, because I said, well, look, we can cut this down, we sell the wood, they do the work. And then we started, we put the plan together, and then we're going to do it over sort of 3 years. And then we started taking the front nine sort of section out. And last year we did a lot on one, which was huge. Now you stand there and it's quite open. So now we're probably taking at the moment easily 800 trees out. Yeah. We've got a big section to come out now. But now you can go to one, or if you stand on 11, you can see the eight fairway, six, five, four, three, two. So you can see, I think it's about 13 holes now.
I think it's great that you actually just starts in the perfect place, doing that photo, doing the comparison. You know, I always say the frog in the hot water, you know, when that story, you heat up the, I don't know why these scientists did it, they're very cruel, but you know, you heat up the hot water with the frog in it, and he doesn't realize, and he dies. But if you drop a frog in a the bowl of hot water, he jumps straight out. And that's golf clubs. You know, you don't realize the sort of daily compounding growth of the trees and the self-seeding nature, and from one day to the next it's the same, but it isn't. It's just changed in such a small way that you can't notice, and the imperceptible change that over 50-100 years, even 10 years, adds up to something. So when you put that stark contrast of, this is what it looked like in this year, this is what it looks like today, and you put those side by side, that's the dropping the frog into the hot water. That's the members going, holy shit, you know, how has it got like that? You know, you think, but the reality is, if trees grow, what, 3-4% a year, depends on the type, you know, and you've got 1,000 you've got 1,000 trees, then you've got to be taking, you got to be taking 30, cutting down 30 trees. No, hang on. I'm going to have to revisit this. Yeah, you're going to have to be cutting down 30 trees every year just to stand still. And people don't realize that because they think that's a lot. And that's what you got to do every year. And if you've had then 100 years of growth, then it's not, it's not 30 trees you're taking down. It's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds because they just grow.
As and well leave as it long enough. Self-seeding stuff, you know, that you probably have big teams on that. Do you have seen them often at St. George's Hill?
Yeah.
In the rough. I mean, you have special companies that come in and do quite a lot of that contracting work, do they?
Yeah, they come in and, you know, saplings, the, when you say to the lads, come on lads, we're going to do some sapling pulling, they just look at you and they're, yeah, you think, no,
brutal job. Time?
How much holiday have I got left?
Ah, yeah.
But it is, you have to, so we, to be fair, hands up, we neglected some areas where this is where we're doing over the next 2 months between our six and our eight. We did a, when I first got there, we took some trees down and I built a heather nursery. And it was brilliant. It came on leaps and bounds what we were doing. But saplings started to come up. And, you know, it's out of the way and you just think, but we're sort of 3 years down. We haven't done, and they've, the pines have grown up. It's not bad, but you sort of look, and you take your eye off the
pines.
Ball.
Yeah. What, how did you sort of go across when you did this, when you did this report? Did you sort of take out every tree or did you prioritise certain species over others? Or
It's hard because we work with Surrey Wildlife Trust, and the problem is, they're saying pine trees aren't a main tree of a heathland. And you think that because the golf course is a nice line, but they said, no, it's not, you know, ecology-wise, it's not so much. They want the oaks, beeches are a big thing, not just pines, because they're not great biodiversity, you know, all the ecology side of things. And you sort of think, well, we're heathland golf club.
That's what you associate with heathland, usually Scots pine, isn't it?
Exactly, but it's not the way. But they're coming from a different point of view, so you have to work together. We had to think about it. We're a golf course, and we don't. Some trees are in wrong areas. Our second hole, where we had the big oak tree on the left of the green, and you think,
beautiful tree, but
how big was that tree when it was built? That whole second hole. Did they build that hole around the tree? No, because it was probably 5 foot high, maybe.
Yeah.
So, but when that was a big. When we took that one out, we did it before. Tim Lobb did a before and after. And as soon as he showed the before and after, before it was done, the picture, how it would look, you suddenly look and you think, wow, it's going to look amazing. And that was quite controversial what we did there, but what a hole it's turned out to be.
It's a beautiful hole, that second beautiful par three.
People don't realise that tree wasn't planted on purpose, that it just grew up. But the hole was built before the tree grew, really. 130 years ago.
And then people will say, oh, well, there's always been trees as long as I can remember. Yeah. And, you know, it's part of the human condition, isn't it? Even the oldest members of the club have a very short memory compared to the life of the club. You know, it's you can maybe think back 40, 50 years, but, you know, our place has been around Bledge for 150 years and no one can remember all the way back then.
No.
And you only have to look at the old historical photographs and things to see culturally how things have evolved and changed, and often it can be unrecognisable. So fair play to you, mate, for having done all of that, because it's always an emotive and difficult thing to get past a membership, but always worth doing.
But the picture in the clubhouse we have from 100 years ago shows that there's hardly any trees on the course.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And when you suddenly show them that, you go, these weren't here. This is what's happened. So you have to sort of take the membership back a bit to the beginning of how the course played, how it looked. Oh, it's evolved a lot and changed. But you have to realise that what was there before.
So in terms of the managing the turf now, you know, the actual basics of managing it, now that you have an irrigation system which has allowed you for, you know, to have this programme of overseeding, and you've cleared out a lot of trees, which has given you more airflow and light and all of this. Do you now find that this is an easier course for you to manage agronomically because of this work that you've done?
Oh, massively. I mean, now the airflow and the sunlight, especially for the heather as well, is improving, and the irrigation system is great. You can have it on that balance, just have it on the borderline. You know yourself when how far you can push surfaces moisture-wise. So now we have that control over quite a few of the holes. Like the next ones we're doing, our 17th, the fairy lies so wet because it's always in the shade. So we know when we clear it this year, it'll take 2 years, but to dry out and look good. But it's amazing how we can now look forward and think, right, we can change what we do here. We haven't got to water as much or dry them out more. So it gives you, the grasses as well is a big thing. You know, before you've got so many different types of grass coming through and it looks a bit, doesn't look uniform. So you can now work on that, but it takes time.
Yeah.
But then we've got everything in place.
What are your main grass species on all your surfaces?
Well, they were overseeded years ago, quite along with sort of a bit of old rye in areas that we have come through. So, but we're trying to, everyone goes, should be full fescue, with the tree lines, there's no way we were going to ever be full fescue with the trees we had in the air. So we were, there's fescue sort of, and then we've been looking at, it sounds bad, like the dwarf ryes to get through areas in time. But we want to go quite a bit of fescue, so we're sort of doing a bit of a blend of the both, because now the dwarf ryes are amazing. Cold ryes, you couldn't tell the difference, but you have to look at some, every fairway's different. Some you can really push the fescue now, there's sunlight and you've got the air movement's huge. So now you can go back to, the fescues are so different. But we found when we had the hot, was it 2018?
2018 was particularly, yeah.
I mean, where we had drilled, some of the old fescues just couldn't handle the heat. Mm-hmm. The new fescues go, but the old fescues, I don't know if you find that a lot yourself, you must do.
Yeah, I think hard tops and sheeps really have been the best for the drought tolerance and heat tolerance. Sheep's fescue is probably my favourite. You know our 13th fairway.
So no, I know that's the one that goes
with sheep's fescue.
You can't take a divot.
Not even you can take a divot on that.
Try my best.
I really love that. The dwarf rye, huge fan. Bar Olympic, probably always been the favourite cultivar. And now they've got a new one as well, which we're going to find out some about soon.
Because this is a question not of taste and idealism, but of pragmatism, isn't it? At the end of the day, that's the thing. It's like, do you want a course this is 100% fescue? Yes.
Are you going to have a course that's 100%?
Can you have a course this is 100% fescue? Maybe, but for 99.99% of course managers in Britain, the answer is it ain't possible, mate, because of all manner of reasons. Like you were saying there with the nature of the ground, the nature of the light, the fact that it can stand so long in the heat at certain times, and so is that what you sort of look like? You want to, of course, you want the finer grasses in time, but you've got to work with the practicalities of what you can achieve, because the membership want good grass coverage.
They do, and you think they've paid £1 million for an irrigation system, so you can't, when you dry surfaces out, as soon as we dry areas out and they're a bit browning off, what's happened to irrigation? Is it not working? Like, well, no, we're just trying to dry a few areas out. Right, are you sure? Yeah. And you're thinking, I don't think that sprinkler works. And it's a really hard one, because it's, everyone wants who's paid for the irrigation, likes to see a bit of greenery.
And you don't want to be the course manager who has 100% fescue, but it's all dead, do you?
Yeah.
that's
impossible.
Not going to do your career much good.
Yeah, and you say a lot of golf courses are, I think I played some Moggies here, like the Berkshire, where he's done on the red, the trees they've taken out there and the fairways are amazing. Mm. And all the, you just taking all the oak trees out, and it, when you actually see that on another golf course, you think, wow, this is what we'd like to achieve. But to get pure fescue, I've said to members, that have asked that, and some are really religious, well, we're diehard fescue fans, it's amazing. So it's impossible. You can go, if I went through the route of spraying chemicals to get rid of everything else and keep the fescue, I wouldn't have a job.
Are those chemicals still available to you guys?
Laser, and correct me if I'm wrong, is knapsack on fine turf only. So knapsack on greens. You're not allowed to do fairways with that, I'm pretty sure.
Okay. No, I think you have, if you've got, is it 40% cocksfoot? Is it?
There's a bit.
So everyone's got 41%.
Yes.
But it's like,
obviously, rescue, Pinoxidin, which was the best tool for us all. Especially, I'm guessing in your heather, you probably used quite a bit of laser when it was about.
Huge amounts to keep the grasses, unwanted grasses out.
Can you guys just explain a little bit about what those chemicals are, those selective herbicides? Like, how do they work?
A graminicide, which selects the grass that you don't want to. I mean, going from the top, we used to have one called Aramo, which would kill everything but fescue. That was so close to being a Roundup, you know. It was just select everything but the fescue. And then you'd have Laser, which would kill ryegrass, and Bent as well. Laser took the Bent. And Rescue would take Yorkshire Fog and ryegrass, and it would leave the Bent and the fescue. So Rescue was a really good one for... It was always my go-to chemical, and we sprayed wall to wall, and got my heart when it was taken off.
You don't mind a mix of Bent and fescue, do you?
Bent and fescue for us is perfect, but obviously we try and push more of the... We've had actually quite a bad attack of disease, really, this autumn, with it being so wet. Bent grasses have really struggled.
Wet the fescues have been fine. Late in the year.
Yeah. So for me, I mean, Craig Gillam have done an amazing job getting that sward composition from Poa to Bent fescue, and it's a perfect blend. And to the point now where we just keep putting more fescue in, but always want the Bent in there, and that's always been fantastic. And fescue fairways, fescue everything else.
Yeah, of course.
With a little bit, sometimes a little bit of dribble of dwarf rye through your par 3 tees just for recovery.
Is that because, you know, there are certain attributes that you have and fescue, obviously, in your greens and your surrounds and fairways as well, I guess, but it's so fine, it doesn't put up much resistance to the roll of a ball, but on a path or on a tee, it's not going to be as hardy as a ryegrass.
Just would not last, you know. But on the... contradict myself here, I remember playing what's called Cabot Highlands now, calling it was Castle Stewart, and Chris Aspel at that point had fescue
Castle
walkways
is the world, like
loads of golf, you know, but they were probably closed in the winter, weren't they? Which would kind of help, but rye walkways always.
Well, the far north of Scotland manages to have extraordinary fescue. You go to Brora, you go to the greens at Brora, they're amazing.
Yes.
And Chris, you know, has helped them over a long period of time. I guess as well, the climate, and it's very dry. You know, lots of people don't realise just how dry the northeast of Scotland is. Not necessarily the northwest, but the northeast of Scotland. Mm. So dry, and probably the ideal climate really for growing that type of grass.
Thrives up there, definitely thrives.
Different parts of the country, maybe not the same old story. So,
I think it takes a good greenkeeper to select the right species for your greens and for everything actually, and not to get hung up in the snobbery of fescue really. And I've always said rye grass is better than no grass, you know. So.
Yeah, that's it. Choose
a bit here and there beside greens and walk-offs, whatever.
It's not choosing between fescue and rye, it's choosing between rye and nothing.
You just bolster it. I think even a lot of the football pitches have little bits of fescue through their rye grass sometimes. I remember
John Mack told me the other day that even stronger than just pure rye is actually when you have a mix of fescue and rye, because
fills the gaps in.
The lignin capacity of the roots or something, they bind together and they're a bit, I don't know. I'm off my comfort zone here, but it's a fascinating subject, because you've clearly transformed a lot of the course in just a few years, really, Andy. What's next on the sort of projects and next schedule of work for Woking?
Once we finish the trees, then we're looking at really renovating all the bunkers. We've done a lot of it's in-house, so do a lot of the shaping, and we obviously transplant a lot of heather, so we've got that. Heather's just an ongoing thing we do every year between October and February. We just transplant a couple of thousand square meters at a time.
So you physically bring it in from your nursery or from off-site?
So we go off-site. So when I first started at Woking, I still knew all the people from Surrey Wildlife when I was from Queenwood. So I did a bit of Burr Hill as well when we were there. They did two little holes with some heather, and we regenerated the heather there, and it was brilliant. Rob just let me crack on. And that just something else. And then when we went to Woking, got back in touch with them, and I said to the club, look, if we invest going forward Heather's Instant, transplanting Heather's Instant. So look, where Woking had done before, they'd stripped areas, just tucked brush down. The problem is weeds just come through, it didn't grow, and the members just keep seeing bare areas. And that's one thing they did say to me to start with, we don't just want areas stripped and nothing.
You're looking at about 4 years, correct me if I'm wrong, or something like that, aren't you, from brashing to having good coverage?
Yeah, and that's, you can get, we're trying to get it quicker, and that's why we're doing different sort of tests and, you know, projects to see how we can do it. But with the heather transplanting, we just found, because it's instant, visual-wise, the members loved it. It's just like, wow. They'd play one weekend, the next weekend, we'd have our six hole from the ditch upwards used to have no heather at all.
And yeah, it's so beautiful.
And now we did all the ditch in a week. We did the bunkers, and then the members came a week later. Like, oh my God.
Okay, so when you talk about transplanting heather, that, you know, I'm so interested in that process. So you've got trees there currently, let's say, that you're taking out, and what's the process? Because I can't just imagine you can just lash the heather on top of the, you know, the 100 years of leaf litter that was underneath. Is there a bit of restitution work?
Yeah, so we first see where we're doing it. The heather that's there already, we try and keep that there, but just do a lot of work on that, ripping out and trying to reseed these areas. But other areas where heather used to be years ago and it's just grass now, we first strip the areas out. But then we go off-site to the commons with Surrey Wildlife. They allow us on. We're the only golf club allowed on one site. Ash Ranges, it's huge. I mean, it's miles. And they want 5,000 square metres a year taken. And they only give us 1 week because it's a live firing range.
Oh, God.
So 1 week before Christmas, we're always there. But you have to, a year before, you have to cut everything down. So you can't just turn up, cut it right down. Because they'll just come and say, we want you to take this heather. Now, it's not lovely heather cut to 4 inches, pure, so you can't spray anything, so we have to go there a year before, cut down even the woody and start again.
So you want it feeling more like a heather turf almost,
So we know what we can take, and we, over the years, it's great because we've taken heather when we've turf cut. We've got a turf cutting blade, a special heather blade, which is great, so it allows us to take. But with the Surrey Wildlife, you can't just take 100 square meters patch. Sometimes you can, other times they want wiggly lines done here and separate, so the sand lizards and the heather beetle, in a way, we're doing it for that. We're not just taking heather for no reason, so we have to make sure.
That's interesting. So it gives sort of little routes and little avenues for the creatures to navigate the sites. So that's their benefit of you coming in and taking.
There's no one that can do that. And what they've been doing for years, they just strip and move the heather to one side.
And just leave it.
And just leave it. So we're in with them, helping them, so we can transplant it back to Woking. But also in Ash, it's not far from us. So we're helping to connect up the heathland through Surrey. So it's a big, they think it's amazing, you know, how what we do. And they didn't realise, I gave a talk to them and walked them around the club, and they'd never seen heather turfing on a golf course. When they saw what we were doing, they were blown away. They were like, wow, you're connecting up.
We didn't think about
the connecting up, but they just said, oh, we just thought they didn't know about bunkers. A lot of them don't play golf, Surrey Wildlife. So now when they see what you're trying to achieve, so you're both getting something out of it, which is great.
Yeah, sustainable. So, sustainable at the end of the day. That's the point, isn't it? You're recycling what's, you know, one man's trash is another man's treasure, isn't it? And that's...
Yeah.
If you were to go and buy that heather, that would cost you a fortune.
It's huge money to buy that heather.
And do you have to reinstate the areas where you've taken from with brashings, or does it just come up? Is the seedbed just still there underneath?
Yeah, so when we strip it, we don't take too much. So we've taken heather turf, thick soil underneath the black, lovely. But really, we've done it at an inch depth. We've done it at 2 inch. It all survives. We found this, but the hardest part, we brought a lorry, we brought the crates, 170 crates we have.
And so it's just like a little slab that they're cutting off and lifting?
Yeah, so we cut them just like turf. So we do the heather, then we edge and iron it, you're taking it up, putting it in the box, then put it onto a trailer and sort of carry on. But we found the boys that are lifting it, you got to make sure when we do this, we keep it quite thin. But in a box, we can put 15 to 18 square meters in each box. But when we're doing it, we just strip, do it, and we leave it. We don't have to clean. We just clean up, mate. We bring all the soil, any soil that there, we put it in bags and bring it back, because it's great for divoting the heather, because you don't want to put any other high pH soil in. But we leave it, and then we keep that sort of humus in there, the black, lovely black, and it just regrows. Mm-hmm. It does come back to the time, and so we're helping each other. You know, sometimes we can take massive areas. The other year, we took 2,000 square meters out of one big area, so it's a lot easier. You can just strip. But then this year, again, we had to do squiggly lines into the south facing, so the sun. So there's different areas you have to do different. It can be quite hard.
What a great learning process it is for you doing that. You know, it's pretty...
It is. It's great.
This is your new bridge, isn't it? We've left the bridge at Bucknamshire.
Yeah, and this is now the thing we're excited about.
Yeah.
Now in this project.
This is my Natterjack Toads.
Yeah.
Exciting thing. So yeah. This is where I get a bit. But.
So what else? Obviously, you transplant us in that way. Are there any other techniques or ways that you've explored of getting heather in different ways across your site?
Yeah, so a lot of people, you know, everyone cuts and collects their heather every sort of October time and might use it and put it down as brash. And I don't know, I just thought, well, come on, there must be other ways we can try here. And we had a nursery, we stripped an area left of our six hole in between six and eight, got rid of all the trees, stripped it. And we had a little slitter, an old tractor slitter that we shaved down a bit so we could do lines. I said, well, let's try sieving the brash down to seed. So we made these sieves up. Our mechanic made the sieves up over a barrel, put the brash on, get it down, and it just gave you the seed pods with a bit of rubbish as well. But so we sieved it down, and then we thought, well, let's look at actually trying to drill this seed in lines. So then we got this area, we put the slitter over, had lines going away through, and then use a drop spreader, put it all down over the whole area, sort of, and then it rained the next day and we just thought, we'll let that seal it. And we sort of did that in my first project there, and that was in the March time, because we knew we weren't going to be blowing and everything, and then by June we had sprigs come up in lines.
Oh, wow. Oh, wow.
And we took all the pictures and I thought, wow.
So that's fine.
How can we improve what we do every year?
Patent this technique.
Yeah, and every, you know, some people go, oh yeah, well, it's just luck. You don't know. It could be just luck, but because I've got the pictures of the lines coming up, so now that's lovely heather through there, and we can use that if we want in time. But then the next year, I said, right, well, let's try and improve what we do every year. So then we've been sieving the seed down. We had it sent off. A seed company took it away because they were looking at seeing it was 72% proof. Which thought, well, if you come back and say there's only 10% seed in what you're doing, then we'd just stop what we're doing. But we sieve down every year. But this year, then the other year, we thought, well, let's heat it over the winter time, dry it out and heat it to sort of 15 degrees. And then it just opened.
Just start popped. The germination process.
Yeah, it just popped a little bit. And then we started seeding. And
do you have to turn it over in a shed? I'm guessing I'll have an image of this, a shed with lamps, heating lamps.
So we had the heating lamps. You have to keep turning it over every day,
right?
Because just even when you put it in there, because when you in October, you're never going to get a nice dry day to cut and collect. So we have to keep turning it over for a couple of months. Then we dry it out when we've got to have just this pure seed, and then we can just bag it up once it's dry. But it just pops a little bit. You can just see it popping through, and then again we just drill the seed in, and then we've just been trying different techniques. And now you drill the seed, and then we put a bit of brash over the top to keep the heat in a bit, and that improves it even more. And then this year we're working with mycorrhizin mixed with the seed, and trying to get that and see if that's quicker. Because if you strip areas off, we're lucky where we can transplant, it's instant, so members love it. But we're having to strip areas where the irrigation and where we feed fairways a bit, the fairways at the side of heather's declining a bit, and with golf since COVID is doubled, and our heather's in decline in certain, dropping where landing zones are. So we're gonna have to strip these areas. But if we can't transplant the heather there, because there'll only be a certain amount of transplant heather you'll do over the next 10 years, so the seeding areas, if we can seed but get germination within a few months, and then the next year it's sort of there 4 inches, then it's great.
Comes
so we're just trying to sometimes it can take 4 years, you think, but if we can find a technique, We might not find it, but if this mycorrhizin and the heating does work, then suddenly we're like, wow.
It sounds like you're getting closer to every step. Do you have other course managers? Like, you know, we've got a great network between Sunningdale, Berkshire, etc. Do you all get together and you share these ideas? Do they come to you for help, or do you...
We sort of speak quite a bit. There's quite a few that we talk to and ring. If I put stuff on Twitter sometimes and you find out what other people are doing as well, what they're just putting brash down a lot of people, and it's just, oh, that's what we do. And because that's the way forward, it does work, but it takes time. But because we've got the time, luckily, because we transplant,
yeah,
and it's instant, and members see that. They don't see the other work we do. So we have that sort of time where if we do, we're not just seeding, stripping airs and just putting brash down. So I think we can just keep, but we keep in contact. There's quite a few that we speak with, and Grant at Parkstone's great. What he's trying down there and doing a lot. And a lot of them ask about the transplanting. How can they transplant? I know because Grant got a big project at the moment and he needs a lot of heather
around his putting green.
Yeah, and it looks great, but the amount of money he's had to spend on the heather. Mm-hmm. But there's not a lot of heathland areas where you strip and be able to have that opportunity, which we have.
And Stevie at Queenwood as well, he did quite a lot of huge projects on that par three.
Yeah.
Basically the whole carry, didn't he? Left so and right, and instant heather.
Queenwood, probably the biggest ones as well. They stripping heather and taking it, and it's amazing, you know, they've got a big workforce where they can just send out and they do the same. So, but it's at Queenwood, they wouldn't be able to just strip areas and seed. Yeah, you know, they have to be instant.
Because it's already... It's already a 10 out of 10. They don't ever have a chance to have any kind of projects open for long. No. I always get the impression. But
I have a question, guys, as you know, I know how both of you do value the networks and the support of other guys in the industry. And I'm thinking there's got to be places out there, courses that have more heather out of play on land that they don't need. You know, I'm thinking of Wallasey, where Wallasey has so much sand, massive sand hills, but there's another course down the road where they don't have any sand, but they have loads of rich topsoil, and if you know, John at Wallasey might bemoan the fact that he doesn't actually have any soil, and that is his limiting factor, and because he wants to make some root mix or whatever else. And I'm just thinking, everyone's got different requirements, everyone's got different assets and attributes and things that they have on their site. You know, if Hank the Common has 900 acres of land and some of the biggest, you know, stretches of heather in the country, and they certainly don't play golf over 900 acres. Is there anything that sort of allows what you've described there, Andy, with the Surrey Heathland Trust, and you can sort of scratch their back and they scratch your back and share resources? Do you think there's ever an opportunity of things like that where clubs share in their resources and benefit from materials, or does it then, you know, become a permitting thing and a licensing thing and doesn't really work? Or I've no idea if it's possible or if it works or if it's something you guys do, but
I'm not sure if you've much experience with that. I think it's difficult. I don't really know how to answer that question.
Give it a bit of thought. But I just think, you know, you go to I go to different places with the nature of what I do, and people have different limiting factors, and it's so often the case that someone else's limiting factor is what someone else has a surplus of, and you just think about trying to marry those things together so that people can, you know, benefit more holistically.
It's a hard one with the heather, because say you have Hankley, a lot of the commons are all run by, say, wildlife companies or MOD land, the army owner. Yeah. Now, the health and safety of going on these, but they only want one thing. They don't want six different golf clubs doing different things on there, and you're only allowed there certain times. It's really hard. They only trust certain people, and you've got to make sure that if you suddenly open up areas and you bring other clubs in, something can go wrong once, and then that's it, finished. So you have to be very careful. If you have opportunities where you, and then again, if you have heather, people are going to say, your membership will straight away go, well, are you selling the heather?
Mm-hmm.
So who profits from that. And there's so much around it that way, helping each other out. Ideas is great, and the seed, you know, we've given some seed, you know, people have trialed our seeds. We're open to that and things, but when it comes to that, it's for us, it's quite hard working with each other.
Mm-hmm.
Because you don't want any profit or benefit in a certain way, because it's, sorry, wildlife aren't like that. You know, they're,
yeah,
it's morally wise, you have to be so careful for heather. That's the heather side of things working with. It's quite
it's interesting.
Restricted, but maybe
to improve your golf course and not to guess make money or
yeah. So if you had big dunes and you could sell top sand. Dressing and people go, oh, we'd love some of your sand. We haven't got any. Is there any way we can? Mm-hmm. You'd think, oh yeah, we probably could help. But then as soon as you go to say the membership, they go, well, how much should we charge?
Now you raise a good point,
and
Andy.
It's, you have,
and you'll always, it's finite, and you'll always will need it one day. So why would you sell it? It's like selling land, isn't it? Really, essentially, and you don't ever, you'll never want to buy land, or buy houses round about the golf course. Never sell any. You know, you wouldn't.
No,
sell
you're right.
Properly.
You're right. Well, yeah. It's just an idea. Never mind.
No, but I'm not selling any of my sand.
Nor my heather.
Yes.
Exactly. Hands off.
No. It's fascinating. And what's the I have a question. In your opinion, what's the absolute perfect medium to grow that you found the heather thrives in the most?
Well, we bring in low pH topsoil. We find heather's shallow growing, the root, so you haven't got to, when we turf strip, we know we haven't got to take sort of 4 inches worth of soil with us.
Mm-hmm.
So we found heather can grow in just an inch of soil, but the hardest part is when we come to shape mounding. So you don't want to just heather when we transplant it, you need to raise it a little bit because of when the water, you've got to think when it rains, where's the water go? If it runs through the heather, you're going to get grasses come through even quicker. Mm-hmm. So you've got to make sure you raise up mounding so the water either runs through it or in certain areas. So we bring a low pH soil in, which is quite expensive, but we just need an inch of that around. But to build the soil up, it's great, and it takes, but it's the hardest part is making sure that those cracks are all pushed together, and when you divot it as well, everything's clear so there's no sunlight through and gaps, because the soil, you can put it on a normal soil on your land, which you think's great, but if that, you know, grasses will grow so quick, and then you're having to use the chemicals and you're fighting, and you, the first year you have to water the heather turf, and then you can sort of then bring it off, so you have to be so careful watering it for a whole year, but not too much, because the grasses came through. We found the other year we did some mounding, and we were rushing, and there was gaps in between a little bit. Oh my! And it was terrible. So we now got a fine art with all the lads. They all have their own jobs. How do we do it? So that's with the low pH, so it just helps us. But you just don't want anything rich.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we find, so that's what we have to bring it in. So it does cost to sort of do this, but
Andy, if you had, say, an area of gorse or an area of, you know, sort of silver birches or whatever that stood there for years, and you said, right, okay, I want this to be heather instead, and you get rid of the actual, you know, the trees or the gorse bushes as, you know, job number one, but then you either look to drill it and seed it or whatever, or let's say you didn't want to just transplant it on top. How would you then get that? What would you do with the soil? Would you take it away and swap it out? Or do you think that the seed bed and all the nitrogen that's been fixed by those other plants being there for so long would just basically not allow the heather to have a fighting chance?
Yeah, so left of our 13th, we had quite a lot of gorse in between the trees. And a couple of years ago, we stripped it completely out. Lovely, nice, rich soil there. And we seeded it with all the heather, and the heather came up really fast because within a few months, you know, the germination was really quick. But then the gorse was coming through at the same speed as the heather. Mm. And then we try, you know, if you try burning it, if you try just bring it, gorse is unfortunately the only way you get around it, because the heather was growing. You think, well, I don't want to rip it out again.
Because you'll take the heather out again.
Yeah, so you have to go around, and then we had to go around dot spraying. With a product, like a herbicide that kills the gorse, but it does kill heather. So we have to change the nozzle so it's just an instant touch. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of work, but unfortunately...
Would that be Blaster or something like that?
Yeah, Blaster Pro is really good, but you've got to get on top of it straight away. But we'll probably have to do that every year. Mm-hmm. You're not going to get round because the heather's growing through. You don't want to scrape it again. And gorse, unfortunately, is
It's invasive. I mean, we're cutting it down to ankle height just now from being 6-7 foot tall. Mm. Knowing fine well that come June, July, it'll all be back and it'll be flowering.
Well, we're pulling it physically out of the ground up in Scotland. It's certainly.
Well, we've done a lot of that off our dunes. We took all the gorse off the dunes a couple of weeks ago. And a lot of that will come back through. You know, we'll have to revisit it, but we're hoping that that we've ripped up that seed bed, that we'll start to get marm grass and stuff coming.
Certain places, though, and Spey is a good example, because for many years, Barry had always sort of just basically rough cut the heather and gorse in certain areas at the same time. And they've almost got this, it's almost now like a carpet of heather and gorse, but then the gorse just has a completely different character than, you know, the leggy, tall, hard stuff, and it's just the soft, supple bit at the bottom. Do you do anything to the the heather when it comes through? Do you cut it? Do you burn it? Do you do anything to
Grillo or anything?
Yeah, so we use the Grillo. So we cut our heather in October, but we only cut certain areas, so we try and have that different stages of heather.
Yeah.
Because if you just have love, it's great having that, but it's not natural woking style. A lot of golf clubs just cut every bit of heather, but we cut a lot in play, but we have different generations of heather now. You can see through our course what we're trying to bring in. So we sort of can do that, but where the gorse comes through, you have to keep cutting that down, spray cut, and it's sort of something that a lot of clubs I know, Wolverton have been doing that next to spraying as well. The gorse just, it takes over so quickly. Within a year, how quickly gorse can fly. And then the heather doesn't grow as quick, you know, but heather's so hard to grow sometimes. It's the right conditions. But so that's what we're going to be doing every year now, is just spraying the gorse out. We have a big, we've got a digger with an arm that we've been pulling, which we've done great on. It looks great. We've taken the big snuff out, but it's going to come through because you've disturbed the soil. You've got sunlight in there now. You've taken the trees down. And that's a big thing. When we've taken the trees down, you have to think ahead, well, what's that going to look like? What seed are we going to do? So we're looking at the fescue. Once we take the trees out, the fescue in there. But a lot with the heather we transplant, we bring back, it's pure, lovely. But when we put it in certain areas, you never know what was in there. And we find a lot of saplings coming through in areas, or nettles we found in some of the stuff we brought back. So with the tree, you never know what's going to come back once you take that away. Mm-hmm. So the sunlight comes in. So you could end up with loads of different kind of grasses coming through and saplings.
It's a never-ending job, isn't it?
No, and it's, you can take, you can take your eye off the ball. You're looking somewhere else before even gone back. So we have to now, what's one thing we're doing is going back to areas we've done last year beforehand, and just keeping on top, because the members are sort of, oh, it's great putting all this heather in, but we had a few grass and weeds come through in one area on our first carry where we lost the heather, and they're like, oh, what's the point bringing heather in if you can't look after it? It was only one patch.
Do you know, but it's like a job in itself, and it just shows the intensity of a course manager's job role, where, like, we've talked for the last hour about, like, heather management, but then you've also got to think, well, I'm still, I don't want to take my eye off the ball when it comes to all my tournament golf that's going on, or looking at my surfaces, or renovation times, or construction, and then you're on your health and safety, your staff, your machinery,
your bridges.
It's unbelievable. You know, the bridges, you could pretty much employ a full-time heather expert there, you know, that's the thing, you know.
Yeah, college-wise, you know, the things you can, it just needs someone, because it's another part, and then we don't all know ecology greatly and biodiversity and everything like that. So you have to, it's a different, something completely different. So you have to get other people on board and share it. But it's tough, because it's another job like yourself. You know, it's, you think, oh, I've got all that to do, but then I'm looking after the golf course, I'm looking after this, but
your head's fried. I know. I bet Ryan Nodes is sitting with a notepad just now writing all this down. He'll find this episode. Ryan from the Addington will find this really.
He'll be coming along and knocking on your door.
He's
next
a heather
week.
Badger.
Yeah, he is.
I know. Yeah, he's. I was going to finish up with just telling you about the transplant we did up at G West, which I actually did a talk on ecologies about it, because it's absolutely fascinating. But it was hardcore. We'd literally strutted, bought a double chop flail that we bought in Devizes. We went on a road trip. So we cut all the, is it fourth generation heather? What would be the woodiest at the end of this? We'd chop that down, like you say, just to get the seed bed. And we'd have like a pizza wheel. cut them all up. We'd have a guillotine, so we'd go in like the buck rake translocation bucket and snap a guillotine on top of it. So you'd take it the square meter, and the digger excavator would put these on the back of 12 pallets on the back of a flatbed. And on top of the 12 pallets, we'd put another 12. So we're taking 24 square meters at a time from the top field through this forest into a clearing where we would have a JCB put in the back of an Arctic lorry. And the Arctic was literally climbing up into the Ochil Hills. Sleet, snow, we'd have to pull it up sometimes with a tractor. And to see an Arctic lorry cutting cider stacked to 84 square meters of turf, I mean, it was unbelievable. You think it's not stable, but you can see it sticking out the cutting side. We ripped loads of cutting sides. Then we go down back all the way back through the hills, back up to Blackford to G West, and then we would take it all off there and lie it out, and then it would get taken out and then put round the bunkers. And after a point, we were like, it was just taking so long. Yeah. And then we did start brushing it after that. That's why I came up with a 4-year thing, because I went revisited G West back 4 years after, and the stuff we'd put up round 18 had stuck to come through. It was an inch tall or whatever, 2 inches tall. But you're right, it was full of just crap all round about it.
Do you think there'll be gorse on at G West in time for its opening then, Blitch?
I'd love to see what this heather's looking like now, and if I don't know if any G West boys listen to this,
about
they could maybe send us some
25
photos.
Years to grow in.
Aye, yeah. The heather's, it's either epic or it's dead. I don't really know, but we'll never know. But it's an absolutely fascinating talk, Andy. I think it's
thanks so much for coming and giving so much of your time.
We've never talked about this side of it before.
I'm sorry, we got a bit carried away there, Bledge, didn't we? We really did, but we're so grateful that you spent that time with us, Andy. Thank you.
Really appreciate your time. Thank you very much.
Right, well, we're looking forward to coming and seeing you at Woking at some point, seeing all the great work. But yeah, great work, mate. And speak to you soon.
Thank you.
Thank you, Andy. Thank you.